looking forward to being able to study the Word of God with you tonight, and then also to do that tomorrow night as well. I invite you to go ahead and turn in your Old Testaments to the book of 1 Kings. We're going to be in 1 Kings for the most part this evening. We're going to be in the 18th and 19th chapters of the book of 1 Kings. Before that, just a little geography, though. Not that geography was even my favorite topic. I didn't really much care for the study myself, but there is some interesting things about the land of Israel. I do not have a map on the screen right now, but if you were to look at a map of Israel in the back of your Bible and you trace down the coastline, you are going to see this little piece that juts out into the Mediterranean Sea there in the northern coastal area of Israel. Well, that little area that juts out into the, looks like it juts out into the middle of the sea is Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel is mentioned in the book of Joshua as one of the areas that was conquered. It was apparently a dividing line between some of the tribes, and was also a religious site for even much earlier than the days of the Israelites. The Egyptians even considered Mount Carmel to be a sacred place. And significantly to what we're going to be talking about tonight, it is also one of the most fertile areas in all of Palestine. It receives somewhere between 26 and 36 inches of rain every year, and has forests growing on top of Mount Carmel. This, of course, is a picture of that mountain. But for most of us, when we hear that name, Mount Carmel, there is one event that comes in our minds. It's the event that's going to be recorded in 1 Kings chapter 18. And if any of us were to go and to visit Mount Carmel today, we would even see a statue there commemorating that event. We refer to that event oftentimes as either Elijah's victory over the Baal prophets, or if we want to give proper credit, we'll say God's victory over Baal. It is, of course, here at Mount Carmel that that event occurred. And while that was a victory, what we may not oftentimes consider is just how dark times were in Israel leading up to that victory, and even how dark times remained in Israel following that victory of Elijah over the prophets of Baal. And that's going to be our focus tonight. What is it we can learn from the life of Elijah and this encounter that will help us to have faith in the dark times that we experience in our lives? And I think a significant lesson that we can learn from this. Well, first of all, let's just set the scene for how dark the times were in the days of Elijah. We could go back even and just know some things about the history of Israel. Again, I won't make you memorize the kings, but by the time we get to the prophet Elijah, the kingdom had divided in around 930 B.C. Elijah began prophesying somewhere around 865 B.C. So you're looking at about a period of 70 years. Israel had had seven kings in those 70 years. Now, in our political system, you might think, well, that's no big deal. Seven leaders over 70 years is no big deal for us at all. But when you're looking at a dynasty, at a kingdom, you would expect to get a little bit more than 10 years average per king. But that did not happen in Israel. In fact, oftentimes, the reason why was because of bloody uprisings. In fact, you see, even on our map here, Jeroboam I was the first king of Israel in the north. He was succeeded by his son Nadab, but then Baasha overthrew Nadab and slaughtered all of the house of Jeroboam. Well, Baasha rules over Israel. He is followed by his son Elah, but then Zimri does the same thing. He overthrows the entire house and slays all of the descendants of Elah. Zimri reigns for about 7 days. The commander of the king's army, a man by the name of Omri, he is coming. He knows, well, I'm not going to be able to withstand the power of Omri, so he actually burns the palace down on top of himself. So Omri then comes into power. We do not think much about Omri. It is his son, though, Ahab, that we are more familiar with. Of course, Ahab and his wife, Jezebel. But of course, it is not only the unstable nature of Israel at that time, it is also the gross immorality and the lack of a spiritual compass that Israel had in that time. Go back to 1 Kings chapter 12, and you see, of course, that began in the days of the first king of Israel, Jeroboam. So you read in 1 Kings chapter 12 and beginning in verse 25. Jeroboam built Shechem in the country of Ephraim and lived there. And went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will return to the house of David. A descendant of David ruled in Judah. Jeroboam is concerned that now the kingdom is going to return back to the lineage of David. They're going to go south and proclaim him to be their king. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will return to their Lord, even to Jeroboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Jeroboam, king of Judah. And so what does he do to rectify this situation in his mind? He builds golden calves. Stations one at Dan in the far northern area of his kingdom. Stations one at Bethel, the far southern area of his kingdom. Leads the people astray into idolatry. Well, of course, when we come to the reign of Ahab, go over now to the 16th chapter, we see that the situation has become even worse. 1 Kings chapter 16. And let's begin reading in verse 31. It came about as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that he married Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went to serve Baal and worshipped him. So he erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. Ahab also made the Asherah. Thus Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel than to all the kings of Israel who were before him. It was not bad enough that Jeroboam had violated the commandments of God, led the people in idolatry. At least Jeroboam might have said, well, I'm still saying we're worshiping Jehovah God. We're just worshiping him in the form of these golden calves. But now Ahab has led the people into worshiping other gods. Now we might question, well, why? What's the appeal here? Now we read so much about Baal worship in the Old Testament. We read that as a constant stumbling block to Israel. Well, it may not be much of a stumbling block to us. But in this agrarian society, a people that make their living from the land, they were constantly looking to the sky. Constantly looking to the sky for rain. And of course, God has promised that if you're faithful to me, I am going to send the rains. But because they did not remove the evil influences from them, and of course, Ahab married an evil influence, they began worshiping other gods. Baal was the Sidonian and Canaanite god of the storm. They worshiped a god whom they thought was going to bring them rain, give them crops, and provide for them. They have rejected the Lord their God who brought them out of Egypt, who brought them into this promised land. They worship another God whom they believe will provide for them more abundantly. That's not all. Continue reading in verse 34. In his days, Hiel the Bethelite built Jericho. He laid its foundations with the loss of Abiram, his firstborn, and set up its gates with the loss of his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun. And of course, that is referencing the words of Joshua in Joshua the 6th chapter in verse 26, where after Jericho had fallen, and all of Jericho was devoted to the Lord, destroyed and devoted to the Lord, Joshua said that whoever rebuilds this city is going to pay for the foundation with his firstborn, and then will pay for the gates with his youngest son. I think that's even more significant than that. Think about this. Why do we even have this recorded? Why is this that God is saying, do not rebuild this city? And then it makes a big deal of it when they do rebuild the city. Well, the interesting thing about Jericho is that Jericho had stood as a fortress in Canaan for millennia. It guarded the inner passes through some of the hill country into the inner recesses of Canaan. That's what is its importance. It guarded the rest of the land from influences and from invading armies that might come from the east. Who is going to guard Israel? God said, I'll guard you. I'm the one who's going to protect you. I'm going to be a shield about you. I'm going to be your hedge. Don't rebuild Jericho. What does it say to us that in the days of Ahab, Jericho was rebuilt? They have no trust in their Lord anymore. They have no confidence in God. They have no belief in Him that He will protect them. No, now they're taking their own protection upon themselves. We will rebuild Jericho. We will make sure that no invading armies can come in. That's how dark times have gotten. And now let's just fast forward a little bit to the 18th chapter. We're going to see in the 17th chapter that in response to all this, God has declared there's to be a drought. You remember the story well. There's a 3-year drought. And at the end of that 3 years, Elijah goes back and he's to tell Ahab that the drought is going to end. You may remember, though, it is not Ahab that Elijah originally meets. This man named Obadiah. Obadiah is described in verse 3 that Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. This is chapter 18 and verse 3. In verse 4, when Jezebel destroyed the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and provided them with bread and water. Here is a man who fears God. Here is a man who's still devoted to the Lord. Ahab does not know this about Obadiah, though. Ahab trusts Obadiah and so says to Obadiah, we have got to find some pasture and some water for the cattle, for the livestock. I'm going to go and search some of the areas. You go search elsewhere. And so it is Obadiah that meets Elijah. Notice what happens, though, when Obadiah first meets Elijah. Verse 7. As Obadiah was on the way, behold, Elijah met him. And he recognized him and fell on his face and said, is this you, Elijah, my master? He said to him, it is I. Go say to your master, behold, Elijah is here. And then notice how Obadiah responds. What sin have I committed that you are giving your servant to the hand of Ahab to put me to death? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my master is not sent to search for you. And when they said, he is not here, he made the kingdom or nation swear that they could not find you. And now you are saying, go say to your master, behold, Elijah is here. It will come about that when I leave you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you where I do not know. So when I come and tell Ahab and he cannot find you, he will kill me. Although I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. How have these dark times affected God's people? Even those like Obadiah who are still faithful to the Lord. He's fearful. You want me to go and tell Ahab that you're here? God's going to whisk you away again, and then what's going to be left? Me facing death. These were truly dark times in the history of Israel. Political instability, religious apostasy, and even the faithful afraid. Of course, it is that setting, though, that we have the events of chapter 18. And the whole point in this episode is to impress upon Obadiah, Elijah, all of Israel, and even Ahab and Jezebel, that God is the one who still reigns. In fact, it is even termed this way in chapter 18 and verse 21. Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him, but if Baal, follow him. And in fact, everything you read in this encounter is all about that question. Who is God? Is it Jehovah or is it Baal? So take, for instance, in the 17th chapter in verse 1, when God declares through Elijah, behold, I am about to send a drought. It is not going to rain for 3 years. Well, what is that a challenge against? In Canaanite religion, in times of drought, it was believed that Baal had died. What's God saying to the people? There's a drought. You need to know there's a drought. You believe in Baal. What does that say about your God? In fact, even earlier in the book of Deuteronomy, God had said that when Israel departed from his ways, one of the first punishments against them would be a lack of rain, a withholding of the water from heaven. This is a direct challenge to Baal. The choice, when you come back, and I'll come down to chapter 18 and verse 17, so when Ahab and Elijah finally meet, and many of you may remember how that encounter begins, Ahab said to him, is this you, you troubler of Israel? And Elijah responds in verse 18, I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, because you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and you have followed the Baals. Now then, send and gather to me all Israel at Mount Carmel, together with 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of the Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. Again, let's just put that picture up there to impress upon us. Why is it that God would even choose this place? Oops, wrong button. There we go. This is one of the most fertile regions in all of Canaan. And in a drought, this is one of the areas that would have held out the longest. So if there was ever going to be a place in all the land of Canaan where the worshipers of Baal might hold out a little bit hope, okay, not everything's dried up here yet. Not everything's dead and brown here yet. There's still some green, so maybe our Baal is still alive, and our Baal can respond to us, and our Baal can send rain and fire from heaven if we ask him to. It would be here at Mount Carmel. And of course, it is that challenge that is issued that also impresses or should impress upon the people that Jehovah was God. You, of course, remember the story. I won't take time to read it. You remember the story. Challenge issued. Here are two oxen. You've got the 400 prophets of Baal, 450 prophets of Asherah. Let them go first, since they are many, and they're going to erect an altar. And they're going to slay one of these oxen, and they're going to lay it on the altar, but they'll light no fire. But they're going to call upon their God for fire from heaven. Now again, what is Baal? He is the god of the storm. Much like Zeus in Greek mythology. And what did Zeus hurl in Greek mythology? He hurled that thunderbolt. Well, Baal, of all the gods, should be able to hurl lightning down from heaven when called upon. So here are all your gods, and they're going to call upon Baal to do exactly what Baal ought to be able to do, send down fire from heaven. Well, they begin in the morning, and they call upon Baal. And they call upon Baal until midday. And you remember it's at that point that Elijah taunts them a little bit. Well, maybe he can't quite hear you. He might be occupied. Gods kind of get busy from time to time. He might just be distracted, or he's away on a journey, or he's resting. So you guys just keep on calling out and call out a little bit louder. And the text goes on that, you know, almost like a fit of madness comes over all of them. They're leaping about and they're jumping about and they're yelling and they're crying and they're cutting themselves and they're crying more and more until it becomes the evening. Now let's just read this to make sure that we see what the text says. Verse 29. When midday was past, they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice. But there was no voice, no one answered, and no one paid attention. There was no Baal in heaven to send down fire. There was no lightning bolt coming from Baal, because Baal was not there. There was no one paying attention to the prophets of Baal. You remember how the story goes on, though. That second oxen is sacrificed. It is chopped up. It is placed on a rebuilt altar that Elijah rebuilds. And a trench is dug. Four large pitchers of water are then poured over it, and again and again, until water is completely drenched the sacrifice and filled the trench around the altar. Let's pay attention again to the words of Elijah as he now calls upon Jehovah God. Verse 36. O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant, and I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that these people may know that you, O Lord, are God and that you have turned their heart back again. It took no raving. It took no repeated pleading. God responded. And the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their face and they said, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." And of course, the story continues with the Baal prophets are seized and they are put to death. This whole encounter is about how God is superior to Baal. God withholds the rain. God sends the fire. And then significantly, even how chapter 18 closes. Elijah crouches on the ground, his face to the ground, sends his servant up to the crest of the mountain. Says, "Look, do you see any clouds coming?" Servant returns, no clouds. Sends them seven times. On the seventh time, the servant returns back to Elijah and said, "I see a cloud in the distance over the sea. It's as big as a man's hand." Elijah knows the Lord is sending rain. Jehovah God is now sending rain. He even says to Ahab, "You go on up to your city. The storm is coming." And surely it did. Now, I don't know about you. That's how I remember the story when I was a kid. That's just wondrous story of Elijah's victory over the Baal prophets, over Baal's defeat by Jehovah God. That's how I remember the story. I don't know why I walk all the way around. The clicker is right there the whole time. That wasn't the whole story. It looked like a turning point. And surely it must have seemed like a turning point even to Elijah. Here, God has answered in this clear and visible means. I have challenged the people. They must decide, who are you going to follow? Are you going to choose Baal as your God? Or are you going to choose Jehovah as your God? And they have seen the answer from heaven. Jehovah is God. And they have even put to death the prophets of Baal. Well, how does chapter 19 begin? Jezebel is told of these actions. And Jezebel sends word to Elijah. Basic message: your head's going to be on a platter by the end of this day. How does Elijah respond? Elijah leaves, goes a day's journey into the wilderness, and then says to the Lord, verse 4, "It is enough now, O Lord. Take my life, for I am not better than my father's." The Lord provides for him there, and then Elijah is taken all the way down to Mount Horeb, the mountain of God. It's the same mountain we noticed the other night in our study, Mount Sinai, where God entered into a covenant relationship with Israel. Elijah is taken all the way down there, and you'll note again Elijah's mindset. When God asks him in verse 9, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And Elijah responds in verse 10, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with a sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." Now you and I already know that's not true. Obadiah was left, the 100 prophets that Obadiah had hidden away was left. God is going to reveal ultimately to Elijah there are even more that are left. But what is Elijah's mindset? "I thought this was the turning point. I thought this is what was going to get Israel back on track. Clearly it did not. This is despair. These are dark times, and the dark times are not going away anytime soon. God, just end it now, if you would." I think it's significant. Verse 11, God says to Elijah, "Go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. Behold, the Lord was passing by, and a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rock before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire." Let's just stop there. What's significant about that? Well, I think it's the very reason why God brought Elijah back to this place. You go back in your Old Testament, you read in Exodus chapter 19, verses 15 and 16, that when God originally spoke to Israel on Mount Sinai, it's exactly how the mountain looked. The earth was rumbling. The earth was quaking. There was fire on top of that mountain. Israel could look and they could know, yes, here is Jehovah God. And I think that's exactly what Elijah was looking for. Here it comes. Here comes God in power and might, and now finally God is going to make everything right. God is going to put an end to all this madness and this nonsense. Things are finally going to be the way that God intended. I need the God of earthquake and fire. And after the fire, a sound of a gentle blowing. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." The Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram, and Jehu the son of Nimshi you shall anoint king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abimaholah you shall anoint as prophet in your place. And it will come about that one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall put to death, and the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal and every mouth that has not kissed him." What's God's response? It was not the earthquake, the fire, the terrible presence of the Lord that Elisha was probably desiring. Yet it was assurance. "Elijah, I'm still here. Elijah, I still have work for you to do. Elijah, I'm still going to take care of everything." Turn over in your New Testaments, if you would, to the book of 1 Peter. And go to the 4th chapter. When I first was looking at this encounter, this story, it got me thinking that we kind of do the same thing. We are oftentimes looking for that key turning moment, that this is now, this is the time when everything's going to get back right again. I'm 40 years old, and I'm already the old man who's saying, "I can't believe how far this world has gone." I know there are those in this room that you look at this world and you think, this is nothing like the world I knew when I was growing up. And yet, what are we constantly doing? We are constantly looking for, here's that key turning moment. For some of us, it was 9/11. We thought, okay, now, finally, wake up call. Our country, our society, we're going to start thinking about the Lord and we're going to turn back to Him. That lasted for about 12 hours. We think politics that way. We think, okay, if we can get the right people elected and make sure the government's going in the right direction and maybe we can get some Supreme Court justices that are going to go the right direction, finally, this world is going to get going back the way it's supposed to. Nothing's getting any better, is it? We think of things that way. That God is going to answer us somehow in some big, huge way, that these dark times aren't going to be so dark anymore. 1 Peter chapter 4, read with me beginning in verse 12. "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of His glory you may rejoice with exultation. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. Make sure that none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or evildoer or as a troublesome meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he is not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. For it is time for judgment to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it is with difficulty that the righteous is saved, what will be become of the godless man and the sinner? Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. There's a couple of things out of that passage that impress me. I have a tendency to tell the people, don't worry, it's going to get better. People are going through a dark time in their life. I say, you know, keep faith in God, everything's going to get better. Peter did not tell them, don't worry, it's all going to get better. He said, don't be surprised. Don't be surprised that you're going through this fiery ordeal. And he does not say that fiery ordeal is going to end anytime soon either. He does say, now make sure when you suffer that you're not suffering as some common evildoer. If you're suffering for the cause of Christ, you have some assurance then. And he makes the point, if judgment is beginning, I think what he's talking about is he's looking at the Christians in that society. They are suffering. That is a form of judgment. And if it looks like we are scarcely being saved, what about the godless and the evildoers when real judgment comes upon them? Here's the assurance. Not that everything's going to get better. Not that these dark times are ending anytime soon. The assurance is this. Those who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. Dark times may not be going away anytime soon. Maybe not for the rest of our lives or the rest of this world's life. The Creator is still faithful. And we still entrust our souls to Him. Maybe it's not even a general societal evil that we're plagued by, though. Maybe it's our own personal shortcomings and failings. Perhaps we've all been there, that we've been struggling with some kind of temptation. And it looked like finally we hit that turning point. We finally gotten this under control, and yet what's next? There's just something around the corner. There's a new temptation. Or maybe we put one physical illness behind us, and now there's a new physical malady around the corner. It just keeps on coming, keeps on coming. The fifth chapter, verse 6. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you at the proper time. Casting all your anxiety on Him because He cares for you. Be of sober spirit. Be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. But resist him. Firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. And after you have suffered for a little while, the God of all grace who called you to His eternal glory in Christ will Himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. Again, what would we like? God in His awesome power and might just putting an end to all the schemes of the devil right here and now. Peter does not make that promise. He says your enemy's still out there, still prowling around. He is still looking for any weakness in you and in me that He may exploit. If times have been dark, do not assume they're going to get that much better. What's the assurance? After you've suffered for a little while, the God of all grace who called you to His eternal glory in Christ will Himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. We extend an invitation to end our services tonight. We extend an invitation for you to be a child of God. For you belong to the King of Kings, the Maker of all things, the Ruler. I'm not going to give you false hope, though. I'm not going to tell you that by becoming a follower of His, that your life here on this earth is going to get just that much better. It may not. It may, in fact, get worse in some ways. Dark times. And they're not getting any lighter as far as I can tell. But what you will have is the same assurance as we give in Elijah. I'm still here. God says to him, I'm still here. And I am going to take care of all of this. And I am going to preserve my godly ones. Ultimately, God is going to take care of all of this. One day. And He's still going to keep His godly ones. Can we aid you? Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?
The Lord told Joshua to go to Jericho and to march 7 times around. He followed faithfully the blessed Lord's command, and the walls came tumbling down. Yes, the walls came tumbling down. Joshua marched 7 times round, and the walls came tumbling down, and the walls came tumbling down. If you are trusting in the power of the blood, and you hope to wear a crown, go forward quickly and obey the holy word. Walls of doubt will tumble down. Yes, the walls came tumbling down. Joshua marched 7 times round in the walls. All the walls came tumbling down, and the walls came tumbling down. The Lord is calling sinner, come to Him today. Turn from this vain world's renown. If you will follow Him in faith like Joshua, walls of sin will tumble down. Yes, the wall.